This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
As you were, here we are. I just thought I'd have a little pause, having listened to the beautiful tones of that lovely Lara's theme and a lovely orchestral piece that I've always loved. And we've been doing this now for quite some years on the Arty Farty Show. And I'd like to welcome you to the Arty Farty Show, coming from Otago Access Radio, of course, 105.4 FM. All too soon, and it comes around to time to have the Arty Farty Show on. And what we usually start with is a bit of a rundown on what's happening in Dunedin on the art scene. And of course, we always start with Art Zone, of course, because they are our sponsors or our co-sponsors. And my co-host as well, Andy. And Andy, unfortunately, is not with us today. It's been a very difficult time with opportunities to head away and do different things. And, of course, it's a thriving business, Art Zone. Most of you will know it, of course. It's in Hanover Street. I think the address is, if I've not forgotten, is 59 Hanover Street. And that's the place that you home in on if you're wanting to get things art. Everything that they care to, that you care to mention in the art scene is there at 57 Hanover Street. Did I say 57? Well, I think probably it's quite a big... It's sort of, it have cut the size down a wee bit, so it was 57 and 59, I think. But anyway, it's 57 Hanover Street. Very easy to find, and it's on the right-hand side as you're going down towards the harbour on Hanover Street. Saves you crossing the road. And if you do want to ring them, you just call 477-0211, and you're there. Yeah, 477-0211. And, of course, they have everything that might interest you in the art arena. They have had difficulty, I suppose, with Omicron like nobody else, like everybody else has. But fortunately, they have instituted contactless shopping. So you can actually ring that number, order something. And if it's over $100, by the way, they will deliver it to you. Aha. So it's Andy and Rosemary at Art Zone. Andy Cook and his partner and leading lady and also partner in the business, Rosemary. She's a trained artist. And Andy, of course, is well known in art circles and can give you the kind of advice that is expert advice. And that makes a big difference. You know, it's all very well to buy some paper, but if you ask for the qualities of the paper and what they will do, you won't always get that as fully as you will at Art Zone. They've got 70 brands of artist materials, and they specialise in art spectrum. Winsor & Newton, of course, the old famous brand of art materials. Old Holland and Dale Rowney and Sennelier. So you really have got a choice of some of the finest products that are available in the world. The picture framing, of course, is a great part of their activities. And I get all my picture framing done there. Obviously, we'll have to, because they're very reasonably priced. And, of course, Andy does all that job himself, and he knows what he's up to. And he'll advise you if you need advice. He'll tell you what sort of mats you might want, mat boards you might want to use, whether you want a double mat or not, whether you need it under glass, or if you need a heavier or a lighter frame. He's very practiced in that area. Another thing that they do is they've got a stretching service. Now, that's not stretching you, it's stretching the canvases. And they will actually make anything from a lightweight 6-inch by 6-inch canvas to a heavy-duty 84-inch by 84-inch canvas. That's big. And I imagine that would cover almost anything you might need in the way of canvases. Now, they've changed their hours a bit. I've mentioned this before, and I think it's a very, very useful range of hours that they're open for the average artist, because they've decided to close on Mondays and then open from Tuesday to including Saturday. And that allows time for you to go on a Saturday if you work through the week. And they're open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on a Saturday, and on the rest of the week, 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. So just remember, Saturdays are now available for 10 to 4 o'clock at the shop at 57 Hanover Street, or 59 if you like. You can go to both those addresses. 477-0211. Pretty straightforward. Oh, I should really mention that there are some specials at the moment. This month, I haven't got very much time left on it. 25% off oil paint. And there are a lot of oil painters out there. That gives you an opportunity. I'm not going to say it's very expensive, but it's pretty expensive, you know. So I would imagine that that would be a great opportunity for you to stock up on your oil paints. Well, let's have a look at what's happening with the Otago Art Society. Very active at the moment. The people that are currently leading the charge in the Otago Art Society, the new president, Brenda Nyhoff, and amusingly the other night, she had to draw a prize for the best artwork in the current exhibition. It was just a lottery prize, I suppose you could say, and they went to a lot of trouble to make it as fair as possible. And Brenda, of course, drew her own number. So I've seen it done before, but it was amusing, and everyone took it in good spirit. And of course, Brenda, well deserved. It was really well deserved. She's working very hard as the new president. What else have we got to say? Well, the art awards have recently finished, so it's not probably going to be of any interest to you. But it's always good to see that there's a wide range of artists that are winning these awards. An important thing to be aware of is the shop. The shop is actually a very interesting and a varied offering. You cannot get any of these or most of these articles anywhere else. It's all done by the artists that are the membership of the Art Society. And they have lots of artworks, of course, but not only that. You've got jewellery, you know, brooches and things like that. And there are actually three-dimensional pieces in there as well, because people are stretching their skills in order to do far more than just two-dimensional works. I'm not denigrating two-dimensional works. They're wonderful, of course, but they are becoming, they're offering a much wider range of products in that shop. And if you want to go there, well, it's down in the Dunedin Railway Station, the second most photographed building in the Southern Hemisphere, would you believe? The other one being the Opera House in Sydney. So it's worth a visit down there. If you haven't been there for a while, well, it's a remarkable building. And the Art Society's rooms are up, the gallery, I should say, really, because it's open to the public. And you can go up there and look at what's happening in Otago in the art scene. You go upstairs, and you'll be greeted by a happy-looking artist person, because it's all voluntary work, really, although there is a lady that looks after the sort of the nuts and bolts, I suppose you could say, and she's the most personable young lady. Well, everyone's young when I'm talking about it, and she's well worth it's well worth going up there and having a look at what's on offer. Let's see what else we've got here. Oh, yes, we always talk about the art gallery, and that's pretty important. And the art gallery is, well, they're breaking out and doing all sorts of amazing things. Their winter exhibitions include the Golden Bearing, and that's quite a spectacular piece of, I would say, sculpture. And the massive task of installing the Ruben Patterson's The Golden Bearing is all finished now. A glittery sculpture, part of a new family-focused exhibition called Beyond the Hedge, which takes a journey through the collection by way of folk tales, fairy tales, myths and legends. Ruben Patterson's tree is called The Golden Bearing, and it first took root in Nyamutu, New Plymouth's Botanical Garden, where Ruben was inspired by the highly formal environments of public and private gardens. Yeah, and he also draws from his Maori family and cultural heritage, his father's work as a landscape gardener, and his own prior exploration of plants and artificial flowers in his work. And a bearing actually marks a position or direction on a map, or can act as a landmark. And here, up on the first floor of the Otago Dunedin Public Art Gallery, which is in the Octagon, by the way, it used to be way out in the outskirts almost, near the Caledonian Ground, and it was there for quite a long time, but looking to the future, they built on the site of the old Hallensteins building and a brand new art gallery, and it really is a sight to behold and well worth a visit, because the collection is always changing from the collection pieces that have been owned by the Dunedin Public Art Gallery for years and years and years. Dunedin was starting to really become, well, it was probably the biggest city in 1870. It was the biggest city in New Zealand with 35,000 population, and from there on, they were also the richest city, because they found gold up in central Otago in 1861, Gabriel's Gully. And that gold also made Dunedin the richest city. And this is where a lot of our art, interests in art, sprang, because people were able to afford to have pieces of art. Wonderful. Other things that are happening, well, The Fall, Christopher Ulutupu, that has been on display now. And this is to celebrate Samoa Language Week. And The Fall is by Christopher Ulutupu, and it's a cinema-scale two-channel video installation and unfolds over a series of chapters in which Ulutupu reflects on the instability of the world and particularly a post-colonial discourse around the dismantling of capitalism. In his work, he simply asks the question, what happens when it all fails? when it all falls away, in other words. Thus, the name of his exhibit, The Fall. And it's a really surreal, challenging, and well worth a visit. Important new work that opens space to consider what might endure collapse or indeed triumph in the weight of a change in the wake of a changing world. Yeah, so that's The Golden Bearing. What else, I hear you ask? Good question. Don't forget The Rear Window. The Rear Window is another space that they use, which can be seen from Moray Place behind the gallery. And that's what's new is by Nehana Gordon Stables, and it is it's a moving image practice that he has, and he's exploring romantic and platonic queer relationships, the desire, love, longing, and turmoil that occur in all of these in the video that he has put together. The work follows two cars full of friends driving around at night, so you can stand in front of the window there and watch this artwork, and there's no apparent destination apparently, but a great sense of fun, a revelry, and also restlessness. So have a look at that, well worth not to be forgotten, because it's very easy to go to the art gallery and forget that out there at the back of the gallery, they've got another interesting artwork. Well, I think we've sort of covered what's happening in Dunedin, but I think it's worth considering. You know, many of you are watercolour artists, and we have in New Zealand, and it is centred in Wellington, and it's Watercolour New Zealand, and I believe it's well worth becoming a member of Watercolour New Zealand if you are a keen watercolour painter, because it exposes you to all to all the wonderful watercolour art that's happening in New Zealand, and on the front of their latest newsletter is a painting, the winner of the Watercolour New Zealand Supreme Award, which is called Splash, and it's a street merchant, Chef Chouan, in Morocco, and it shows you the kind of beautiful watercolours that are being produced, and actually opens to any watercolourist's eyes the sort of thing that you can pursue yourself. You can break some of the boundaries that you might have had, and that's just a view of all the watercolourists in New Zealand, but particularly members of Watercolour New Zealand. It's not expensive. You can actually display your work on their website, which is a wonderful opportunity to expose your art to a New Zealand audience. Beautiful watercolour works. These people are right up in the leading echelon of watercolour in the country. And so you'll see interesting works that are realist, and then you'll see other interesting works that are more abstract, and then into the cutting edge of today's art world with figurative work. Wonderful stuff. The Gordon Harris Award, for instance, for innovation in watercolour, and the winner was Interface by Suzanne Herschel. And it's a work in paper in a water-based medium that extends the concept of traditional watercolour painting from illustrative to interpretive. It's the artist's personal comment referencing Armistice 100 and the current centennial commemoration, which has just been happening, invoked by the loss of her children's two great-grandfathers in World War I. And it's a visual metaphor, as she says, for incomprehensible and reprehensible destruction to people, place and land. Well, you couldn't think of anything more relevant today with the Russian and Ukraine situation. All the prize-winning watercolours are shown in their magazine, which is it's worth the fee to be a member, or the membership fee, just to be exposed to this work. in their newsletter, and I've learned many a thing. They actually often provide us with interesting insights into great artists, and they've got Vincent van Gogh. He's such an interesting subject these days. There's a lot of speculation. I've got some more to tell you about that later on. But in the meantime, I think we might have a little bit of music, since we've now covered the news and events around Dunedin and New Zealand in painting. And let's have a listen to... Now, this is a very rare recording. This is, believe it or not, of course, Mona Lisa is one of those paintings that everyone's asked questions about, you know, and they wonder, you know, who was it? Who was that painter? And I think I used who was that subject, rather. We know who the painter was. And the question is, who is the subject? And our most recent speculation, as I mentioned the last time, was that it was actually his mother, Van Gogh's mother. Another speculation is that, no, it's not Van Gogh at all, Van Gogh's mother. It's Van Gogh himself in drag. That was pretty advanced in those days. Anyway, I've unearthed a very, very ancient recording of Mona Lisa by Elvis Presley. And it's a very spare rendition. It's just him and a guitar. And that's quite relevant because the new film about Elvis Presley is coming out. So let's play that.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, in a big bowl. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely that I blame you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile? Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is it your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie and they die. To tempt a lover, Mona Lisa, or is it your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep, but it's rather my darling. Are you warm? Are you?
Well, that's pretty ancient, I would think. Certainly, I don't know, must be close to into the 50s, I would think, early 50s. And that's Elvis Presley singing Mona Lisa, just him and a guitar. Well, there you are. You heard it here. The that mention of Van Gogh, actually, which keeps cropping up. There are all sorts of ideas that are popping up about Van Gogh. and they're trying to get to the depth of really who was a you know a kind of a difficult person to understand. Although he loved music, and I was thinking of him while the while Elvis Presley was singing Mona Lisa. You know, one of his quotes is that I'm talking about Vincent van Gogh, of course. Though I am often in the depth of misery, there is still calmness, pure harmony, and music inside me. There you are. That's. I think music and art are inextricably interlinked. And there's an interesting insight into Van Gogh himself. He's often looked upon as a very odd character. He was a very odd character, but nonetheless there was a depth, not only in his artistic ability, but in his mental capacity. He and Gauguin apparently had a bit of a barney. They were friends, but it was a difficult friendship because they were, well, I think Van Gogh was a bit... problematic in his relationships, they've discovered new research completed new research that sheds light on Van Gogh's problems with Gauguin, as revealed by the paintings of their favourite chairs. And apparently the question was asked, why was Vincent's chair sold to London's National Gallery in the 1920s while Gauguin's chair was hidden away? And, Martin Bailey has shared with us just very, very recently these two paintings, one by Van Gogh, Van Gogh's chair, and one by Gauguin. And why? They were both by Van Gogh. And as Martin Bailey says, I've long puzzled over why Van Gogh's paintings of his own chair and that of Gauguin were separated, because their friendship was well known, and the chairs are obviously a pair, and I think Vincent must have expected them to hang together, facing each other, those two paintings. And the reality is it was Van Gogh's chair was sold by Vincent's sister-in-law, Jo Bonger. Now, she really was a leading part of the exposure of Van Gogh to the public. And it was sold to the National Gallery in London in 1924. Now, Gauguin's chair, which was painted in the same year, so it could have even been painted at the same time, who knows? But it remained with the family, ending up at Amsterdam's Van Gogh Museum when it was established in 1973, so that was a long time later. And it seems unfortunate, as the writer states, to split up the pair. As he said, it also struck me as surprising that Bonger had sold off her brother-in-law's own chair rather than that of Gauguin, who was just a friend. An answer comes in an article by Louis van Tilbourg, a senior researcher at the Van Gogh Museum. It's in the latest issue of Simiolis, the quarterly journal of Dutch art history. In Van Gogh, Gauguin and Rembrandt, he argues that Bonger took a dislike to Gauguin and wanted the painting of his chair hidden away. That's an interesting insight. This interpretation helps us see the two chair paintings in a fresh light. In his article, Van Tilbourg rejects some of the traditional interpretations of the picture, focusing on Van Gogh's artistic ambitions and his partnership with Gauguin. The collaboration of those two artists, which had started off with such high hopes but ended in tragedy, is illustrated by the two paintings. The man presumably both had their favourite chairs in the Yellow House where they lived together in Arles for 2 months in the autumn of 1888. Vincent's own chair was a simple piece of rustic furniture with a straw-covered seat, reflecting something of his more austere personality. Gauguin had a comfortable armchair depicted under gaslight, with a candle and two novels, suggesting a sophisticated man who enjoyed the evening hours. In a sense, the two pictures can be regarded as portraits of the artist themselves. Van Gogh began the paintings in mid-November 1888 with relations between them, when the relations between them were still friendly. He finished within a few days. A month later, the collaboration came to a terrible end when during the evening of 23rd December, Vincent mutilated his ear, and by this time serious tensions had developed between them. Gauguin quickly fled to Paris. In January, Van Gogh returned to the picture of his own chair, adding the pipe and tobacco. And I think you'll all be familiar with this painting. And what had actually been an empty seat when he first painted it. Smoking for him represented consolation and relaxation, which was now much needed. He also included onions in the background, which presumably had a meaning for him, although their symbolism remains somewhat obscure today. Finally, he prominently signed the picture, indicating that it was both his work and a representation of his personal seat. Traditionally, art historians have regarded the two paintings as empty chairs and have linked them with the tensions that the artists were facing. But Van Tilburg points out that in mid-November, when they were mostly done, relations were still collaborative. And when fully completed, he sees both chairs as not empty but occupied. And speaking of presence, one with Gauguin's books and the other with Gauguin's pipe. Vincent sent the two paintings to his brother Theo in Paris in April 1889. And after Vincent's suicide in July 1890, and I must add, it has now been settled that in fact he wasn't murdered, it was a suicide. And in July 1890, ownership passed to Theo, and following Theo's death in January 1891 to his wife Bonga. The public's first opportunity to see Van Gogh's chair came in 1905 when Bonga lent it to a major retrospective of the artist's work in Amsterdam, comprising nearly 500 works. Imagine 500 of Van Gogh's work all together. It is still the largest Van Gogh show ever held. Although most of the important family paintings were lent, Gauguin's chair was not included. Van Gogh's chair, but not Gauguin's chair, was also included in an important portfolio of reproductions of the artist's work, which was published in 1905. From then onwards, Van Gogh's chair was lent to 10 other exhibitions up until the First World War, which meant it came to be regarded as a key work. In December 1923, Bonga loaned Van Gogh's chair to the artist's first one-man show in London at the Leicester Galleries. A few weeks later, it was bought by the National Gallery for just under £800, a king's ransom in those days, I would say, and the funds were actually provided by Samuel Curtol. But it was not until 1928 that Gauguin's chair was first publicly exhibited. This was 3 years after Bonga's death, when the collection was managed by her son, Vincent Willem. Van Tilburg believes that Bonga resented Gauguin because after his friend's suicide, he had tried to claim credit for Van Gogh's artistic innovations. One can also speculate she partly blamed Gauguin for Van Gogh's tragic self-mutilation. The first time the two chair paintings were brought together was at a Van Gogh show at Manchester Art Gallery in 1932, and a newspaper article noted that the pair were among the most notable exhibits and were poignant with meaning, an indication that their importance was finally being recognised. So how interesting to bring the two chairs that were used by Gauguin and Van Gogh together. And when they were separated, it was almost a symbol of their separation that the chairs too were separated and finally brought together at that time. Well, I think we should have a bit of music. I do think. And let's see what we've got here. It's a surprise.
Are you the best or the equal of every man on this earth? I introspect. I can't have anything that I could want. Yet I need for nothing, oh, nothing. the spirit of life is within you. Breathe it with ease through the whole of you. And deeper inside is within you. Searching until we find a way. To jump out now. And jumping around now. Cause sooner or later we'll be gone.
Was a surprise, but it wasn't a surprise to me, even if it sounds like it was. It's actually Simply Red, and that was the first song from his album, which is just, it was Love in the Russian Winter, and that song was The Spirit of Life, which of course is what we all celebrate when we paint. And Simply Red reminds me of a famous painting, that of the Red Studio by Henri Matisse. Now, Henri Matisse gets his place in the timeline of painting because of his use of colour. He did, well, the actual painting that I'm referring to by Henri Matisse, where the Red Studio, he did things with colour no one had before, and he influenced many artists who followed Matisse's Red Studio is important for its use of colour and its flattened perspective, his altering of reality and our perception of space. This was a major change that was happening at the turn of the century. He painted it in 1911 after his exposure to traditional Islamic art during a visit to Spain, which influenced his use of pattern, decoration and depiction of space. And all those who have visited Spain, maybe you've been to the Alhambra, and you will recognize that direction that he'd decided to take. Red Studio gets grouped together with three other paintings Matisse did that year: The Painter's Family, The Pink Studio, and Interior with Aubergines, as standing at a crossroads for Western painting, where the classic outward-looking, predominantly representational art of the past met the provisional, internalized, and self-referential ethos of the future. The elements Matisse included sink their individual identities into what became a prolonged meditation on art and life, space, time, perception, and the nature of reality itself. Or, put far more simplistically, he painted a personal reality, the world as he perceived and experienced it, in a way that makes sense to him. If you look at his earlier paintings, such as Harmony in Red, painted in 1908, so I'll mention that, Harmony in Red, and we're referring first to the Red Studio, if you want to look up those. It was painted in 1908. You'll see Matisse was working towards the style in Red Studio. It didn't pop up from nowhere, but the perspectives were all wrong. The Red Studio by Henri Matisse, painted in 1911, is approximately 180 by 220 centimetres. Quite interesting, you know, how small a lot of these paintings are. When you actually go and see them in the galleries, they take you by surprise. You're expecting something big, because you've seen them portrayed in magazines and art books, and they appear to be, you just imagine they're much bigger. But 180 by 220 is very small. And it's in the collection of MoMA. So I went to, I actually saw this painting in New York at MoMA. Matisse didn't get the perspective wrong. He painted it the way he wanted it. He flattened the perspective in the room and altered it from how we perceive perspective with our eyes. The question of getting perspective right applies only if you're trying to paint in a realist style. That is to create an illusion of reality and depth in a painting. If that's not your aim, then you can't get the perspective wrong. And it's not that Matisse didn't know how to get it right either. He just chose not to do it that way. A painting is ultimately a representation or expression of something recreated in two dimensions. We all know that. And what we're trying to do is, when we're painting, is to fake a three-dimensional look, using perspective and other devices. It doesn't have to do it as an illusion of three dimensions. Western painting styles before the Renaissance didn't use what we now think of as traditional perspective. Chinese and Japanese art forms never have. Cubism deliberately breaks up perspective, representing a single object from several viewpoints. So don't be deceived into thinking Red Studio is a totally flat painting or style. There's still a sense of depth to the room created by the arrangement of the elements. For instance, there's a line on the left of this picture where the floor and wall meet. The furniture may be reduced to outlines, but the table edges still angle in as if they get further away. So does the chair. The paintings at the back are clearly propped against a wall, even though there's no separation of the side-back walls. And in the way, there is between the floor and side wall. But we read the edge of the large painting as being in the corner of the room anyway. It could even be said each element of the painting does experience perspective, but is presented as if the artist was seeing only that point of the painting. The chair is in two-point perspective, the table in one. The window also recesses to a vanishing point. So they're juxtaposed, almost a collage of different perspectives and views. So from that point of view, it's deceptively simple. It was painted in 1911, and it may seem that he just plonked things onto the canvas in the old place, or that he painted the table first and had to fill up the rest of the space with something. I could relate to that, but he was quite deliberate about what he was doing. And the arrangement of the elements leads your eye actually around the painting. And this is something that I talk about in my classes, that if you capture the eye of a viewer, then lead the eye around the painting to the focal point rather than lead the eye out of the painting. So that's really what he was trying to do. Try and look up the red chair. See how this deception was managed. Matisse, I just got a little. They think it's an autobiographical painting. The elements in Red Studio, in fact, invite you into Matisse's world. The empty bit in the foreground reads as floor space. So you have to sort of step in amongst the things in his studio, and it forms a sort of almost a nest, which if you look at your own studio, it's a representation of yourself in many ways, and my studio certainly that certainly looks like a bit of a mess, if I'm struggling to try and find different things at the time that I'm painting, I do hope that it's coming together in the painting, even if it might look a bit chaotic in the studio. I wonder if he's actually describing the creative process when he paints this painting. The table acts as a container for the ideas of food and drink, nature and artist materials, the essence of an artist's life. Representation of different subjects, portrait, still life, landscape, the window for illumination. The passage of time is denoted by the clock that's in the painting. And a comparison is made to the three-dimensionality of the world with sculptures in a vase. And finally, contemplation, a chair positioned to view the art, which drew me partly not just the red, but the fact that we'd spoken about chairs with Van Gogh's painting of Gauguin's chair and his own chair. In the same situation here with the Red Studio. Apparently the Red Studio wasn't initially red. Instead, it was originally a blue-grey interior corresponding more closely to the white of Matisse's studio as it actually was. This powerful blue-grey can actually be seen, even with the naked eye, around parts of the painting and under thinner paint on the left side of the painting. And that forced Matisse to transform his studio with a dazzling red, which has been debated. It's even been suggested it was stimulated in the most perceptual of ways by the afterimage of greens from the garden on a hot day. Because, of course, you see a green is the complementary of red. Hilary Sperling says that visitors to Matisse's studio at Issy grasped immediately that no one had seen or imagined anything like this before. The red studio painting looked like a detached wall segment with rudimentary objects floating or suspended on it. From now on, he painted realities that existed only in his mind. And she adds, it isn't even well painted. Oh, that's a bit tough. She says that looks as if he couldn't make up his mind where to put things. It's just a mishmash of bits with no regard for composition. He could have portrayed his feelings about this room with his pieces in a much more pleasing fashion, and maybe wouldn't have had to explain it. Well, that's tough. The man, has to consider his own expression, and I'm sure he was really knew what he was aiming to do. I'm inclined to take the opposite view of that. Part of the appreciation of the Red Studio comes from context in which Matisse was working and the concept, not solely the actual painting. A comparable example would be the colour field paintings of Rothko, the wonderful play, which is just called Red, about Rothko's life, features the painting Red. And it's hard to envisage a time when covering a canvas with just colour was unprecedented. Who gets written into the books as a master is a question of fashion and to some extent luck. Being in the right places of galleries at the right time, having academics and curators researching and writing about your work, Matisse went through a period of being dismissed as merely decorative and worse, but it has been re-evaluated and given a more prominent role. Now he's well regarded for his simplicity, his use of colour, and his design. Well, that's just a thumbnail sketch of Matisse, and in particular in his choice of red in the red studio, and perhaps a nod to Rothko with his fantastic work Red, which is also at MoMA in New York. Well, we've come to the end, sadly, of the Arty Farty Show, and I'd like to thank you for listening. You've been listening to Otago Access Radio and 105.4 FM, the Arty Farty Show, every fortnight at 11 o'clock. And thank you very much for being part of it. As my listeners, it's Ron Esplin, and being on my own today without Andy Cook here, no doubt he'll be back next time, and I'm looking forward to that. And as always, I think we should finish with something to do with painting, eh? So shall we play? Yes, I think probably... I haven't played this for quite a while, but it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work, and it's by Bread. Remember Bread? Yes. Well, you're about to hear Bread, and they're going to be singing If a Picture Paints a Thousand Words.
If a picture paints a thousand words, then why can't I paint you? The words will never show the you I've come to know. If a face could launch a thousand ships, then where am I to go? There's no one home but you. You're all that's left me to. And when my love for life is running dry, you come and pour yourself on me. If a at one time I'd be with you tomorrow and today beside you all the way. If the world should stop with all things spinning slowly down to dust, I'd spend the and when the world was through, then one by one the stars would all go out. Then you and I would simply fly away.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.